When Americans are sent to Vietnam or West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only. It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops. It ought to be possible for American consumers of any color to receive equal service in places of public accommodation, such as hotels and restaurants and theaters and retail stores, without being forced to resort to demonstrations in the street. And it ought to be possible for American citizens of any color to register and to vote in a free election without interference or fear of reprisal. It ought to be possible, in short, for every American to enjoy the privileges of being American without regard to his race or his color. In short, every American ought to have the right to be treated as he would wish to be treated, as one would wish his children to be treated. But this is not the case. The Negro baby born in America today, regardless of the section of the state in which he is born, has about one half as much chance of completing a high school as a white baby born in the same place on the same day. One third as much chance of completing college. One third as much chance of becoming a professional man. Twice as much chance of becoming unemployed. About one seventh as much chance of earning $10,000 a year. A life expectancy which is 7 years shorter, and the prospects of earning only half as much. This is not a sectional issue. Difficulties over segregation and discrimination exist in every city, in every state of the Union, producing in many cities a rising tide of discontent that threatens the public safety. Nor is this a partisan issue. In a time of domestic crisis, men of goodwill and generosity should be able to unite regardless of party or politics. This is not even a legal or legislative issue alone. It is better to settle these matters in the courts than on the streets, and new laws are needed at every level. But law alone cannot make men see right. We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free. We preach freedom around the world, and we mean it. And we cherish our freedom here at home. But are we to say to the world, and much more importantly, to each other, that this is a land of the free, except for the Negroes, that we have no second-class citizens, except Negroes, that we have no class or caste system, no ghettos, no master race, except with respect to Negroes? Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. The fires of frustration and discord are burning in every city, north and south. Where legal remedies are not at hand, redress is sought in the streets, in demonstrations, parades, and protests, which create tensions and threaten violence and threaten lives. We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. It cannot be met by repressive police action. It cannot be left to increase demonstrations in the streets. It cannot be quieted by token moves or talk. It is a time to act, and the Congress, in your state and local legislative body, and above all, in all of our daily lives. It is not enough to pin the blame on others, to say this is a problem of one section of the country or another, or deplore the facts that we face. A great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all. Those who do nothing are inviting shame as well as violence. Those who act boldly are recognizing right as well as reality. Next week, I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law. The federal judiciary has upheld that proposition in a series of forthright cases. The executive branch has adopted that proposition in the conduct of its affairs, including the employment of federal personnel, the use of federal facilities, and the sale of federally financed housing. But there are other necessary measures which only the Congress can provide, and they must be provided at this session. The old code of equity law under which we live commands for every wrong a remedy. But in too many communities, in too many parts of the country, wrongs are inflicted on Negro citizens, and there are no remedies at law. Unless the Congress acts, their only remedy is the street. I am therefore asking the Congress to enact legislation giving all Americans the right to be served in facilities which are open to the public, hotels, restaurants, theaters, retail stores, and similar establishments. This seems to me to be an elementary right. Its denial is an arbitrary indignity that no American in 1963 should have to endure, but many do. I have recently met with scores of business leaders urging them to take voluntary action to end this discrimination. And I've been encouraged by their response. And in the last 2 weeks, over 75 cities have seen progress made in desegregating these kinds of facilities. But many are unwilling to act alone. And for this reason, nationwide legislation is needed if we are to move this problem from the streets to the courts. I'm also asking Congress to authorize the federal government to participate more fully in lawsuits designed to end segregation in public education. We have succeeded in persuading many districts to desegregate voluntarily. Dozens have admitted Negroes without violence. Today, a Negro is attending a state-supported institution in every one of our 50 states. But the pace is very slow. Too many Negro children entering segregated grade schools at the time of the Supreme Court's decision 9 years ago will enter segregated high schools this fall, having suffered a loss which can never be restored. The lack of an adequate education denies the Negro a chance to get a decent job. The orderly implementation of the Supreme Court decision, therefore, cannot be left solely to those who may not have the economic resources to carry the legal action, or who may be subject to harassment. Other features will be also requested, including greater protection for the right to vote. But legislation, I repeat, cannot solve this problem alone. It must be solved in the homes of every American, in every community across our country. In this respect, I want to pay tribute to those citizens north and south who've been working in their communities to make life better for all. They are acting not out of sense of legal duty, but out of a sense of human decency. Like our soldiers and sailors in all parts of the world, they are meeting freedom's challenge on the firing line, and I salute them for their honor and their courage. My fellow Americans, this is a problem which faces us all, in every city of the North as well as the South. Today, there are Negroes unemployed 2 or 3 times as many compared to whites. Inadequate education, moving into the large cities, unable to find work, young people particularly out of work, without hope, denied equal rights, denied the opportunity to eat at a restaurant or a lunch counter or go to a movie theater, denied the right to a decent education, denied almost today the right to attend a state university even though qualified. Seems to me that these are matters which concern us all, not merely presidents or congressmen or governors, but every citizen of the United States. This is one country. It has become one country because all of us and all the people who came here had an equal chance to develop their talents. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right. Your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have. That the only way that they are going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that. Therefore, I'm asking for your help in making it easier for us to move ahead and to provide the kind of equality of treatment which we would want ourselves. To give a chance for every child to be educated to the limit of his talents. As I've said before, not every child has an equal talent or an equal ability or equal motivation, but they should have the equal right to develop their talent and their ability and their motivation to make something of themselves. We have a right to expect that the Negro community will be responsible, will uphold the law, but they have a right to expect that the law will be fair, that the Constitution will be colorblind, as Justice Harlan said at the turn of the century. This is what we're talking about. And this is a matter which concerns this country and what it stands for. And in meeting it, I ask the support of all of our citizens. Thank you very much.
From the White House, you have heard an address by the President of the United States.
Today's Tuscaloosa episode in the continuing struggle for human rights began just over a year ago. In the Democratic primary election for governor of Alabama, George Wallace, a young state circuit judge, ran as an outspoken segregationist. He clinched his nomination and his formal election in November with an uncompromising appeal to the white population. So strongly was he opposed to desegregation, he declared, that he would stand in the schoolhouse door to keep Negroes out of white classrooms despite any orders to let them enter. Today, George Wallace stood at the entrance to Foster Auditorium at the Tuscaloosa campus of the University of Alabama. But two Negro students, with the power of the federal government behind them, did register, and it's Washington's determination to see that they are not molested as they continue their education. Today's showdown came with all the measured drama of a familiar story. There was no doubt after Little Rock, Arkansas, Oxford, Mississippi, and more recently Birmingham, Alabama, that President Kennedy would use all necessary force to sustain Negroes' civil rights under the Constitution. Governor Wallace, for his part, left no doubt that he sought a dramatic confrontation. Riding a political issue so potent in Alabama and in much of the South, Governor Wallace carefully set the stage with himself at its center. The scene was the doorway, watched by hundreds of reporters with scores of microphones and cameras to catch every word and gesture. Governor Wallace had arranged that there be no distractions. He and his state police had made it clear that they would tolerate no interference from local racial extremists. The university campus was sealed off to all but students, reporters, and police. Today, registration day began quietly. At mid-morning, President Kennedy moved to make plain he was not bluffing and at the same time set the stage legally for what might follow. In a formal proclamation, he commanded Governor Wallace and, in his words, all other persons engaged or who may engage in unlawful obstructions of justice to cease and desist therefrom. At noon, Governor Wallace appeared on the scene. 3/4 hour later, federal marshals drove up with the two students, Vivian Malone and James Hood. They did not get out of their car, but Deputy U.S. Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach approached the governor.
Yes, I am the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. I am here to, accompanied by the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama and by the Marshal for the Northern District of Alabama. And I have with me here a proclamation signed by the President of the United States, which calls upon you to cease obstruction to justice in this state. The proclamation, Governor, was signed by the President within the last hour. I wish to make it clear to you that this is an awfully simple thing. We are asking today is a routine thing. It is simply the enforcement of a court order of which you are aware. And I've come here to ask you now for an unequivocal assurance that you will permit these students, who after all merely want an education at the great university.
Well, now you make your statement, but we don't need you to make a speech. You make your statement.
I will make my statement, Governor. I was in the process of making my statement. And I'm asking from you an unequivocal assurance that you will not bar entry to these students, to Vivian Malone and to James Hood, and that you will step aside peacefully and do your constitutional duty as governor of this state and as an officer of the court, which you are as a member of the bar, and that nobody acting under your control will bar their entry physically or by any other means. May I have such an assurance?
I have a statement to read. As governor and chief magistrate of the state of Alabama, I deem it to be my solemn obligation and duty to stand before you, representing the rights and sovereignty of this state and its peoples. The unwelcomed, unwanted, unwarranted, and force-induced intrusion upon the campus of the University of Alabama, the day of the might of the central government, offers frightful example of the oppression of the rights, privileges, and sovereignty of this state by officers of the federal government. This intrusion results solely from force or threat of force, undignified by any reasonable application of the principle of law, reason, and justice. It is important that the people of this state and nation understand that this action is in violation of rights reserved to the state by the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Alabama. While some few may applaud these acts, millions of Americans will gaze in sorrow upon the situation existing at this great institution of learning. Only the Congress can make the law of the United States. To this date, no statutory authority can be cited to the people of this country which authorizes the central government to ignore the sovereignty of this state in an attempt to subordinate the rights of Alabama and millions of Americans. There has been no legislative action by Congress justifying this intrusion. When the Constitution of the United States was enacted, a government was formed upon the premise that people as individuals are endowed with the rights of life, liberty, and property, and with the right of local self-government. The people and their local self-government formed a central government and conferred upon it certain and limited powers. All other powers were reserved to the states and to the people. Strong local government is the foundation of our system and must be continually guarded and maintained. The 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States reads as follows. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. This amendment sustains the right of self-determination and grants the state of Alabama the right to enforce its laws and regulate its internal affairs. This nation was never meant to be a unit of one, but a united of the many. That is the exact reason our freedom-loving forefathers established the states, so as to divide the rights and powers among the many states, ensuring that no central power could gain master government control. There can be no submission to the theory that the central government is anything but a servant of the people. We are God-fearing people, not government-fearing people. We practice today the free heritage bequeathed to us by the founding fathers. I stand here today as governor of this sovereign state and refuse to willingly submit to illegal usurpation of power by the central government. I claim today for all the people of the state of Alabama those rights reserved to them under the Constitution of the United States. Among those powers so reserved and claimed is the right of state authority in the operation of the public schools, colleges, and universities. My action does not constitute disobedience to legislative and constitutional provisions. It is not defiance for defiance's sake, but for the purpose of raising basic and fundamental constitutional questions. My action is a call for strict adherence to the Constitution of the United States as it was written, for its cessation of usurpation and abuses, My action seeks to avoid having state sovereignty sacrificed on the altar of political expediency. Further, as the governor of the state of Alabama, I hold the supreme executive power of this state, and it is my duty to see that the laws are faithfully executed. The illegal and unwarranted actions of the central government on this day, contrary to the laws, customs, and traditions of this state, is calculated to disturb the peace. I stand before you today in place of thousands of other Alabamians whose presence would have confronted you had I been derelict and neglected to fulfill the responsibilities of my office. It is the right of every citizen, however humble he may be, through his chosen officials of representative government, to stand courageously against whatever he believes to be the exercise of power beyond the constitutional rights conferred upon our federal government. It is this right which I assert for the people of Alabama by my presence here today. Again, I state, this is the exercise of the heritage of freedom and liberty under the law, coupled with responsible government. Now, therefore, in consideration of the premises, and in my official capacity as governor of the state of Alabama, I do hereby make the following solemn proclamation. Whereas the Constitution of Alabama vests the supreme executive powers of the state in the governor as the chief magistrate, and said Constitution requires of the governor that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And whereas the Constitution of the United States, Amendment 10, reserves to the states respectively or to the people those powers not delegated to the United States nor prohibited to the state. And whereas the operation of the public school system is a power reserved to the state of Alabama under the Constitution of the United States, Amendment 10 thereof. And whereas it is the duty of the governor of the state of Alabama to preserve the peace under the circumstances now existing, which power is one reserved to the state of Alabama and the people thereof under the Constitution of the United States and Amendment 10 thereof. Now, therefore, I, George C. Wallace, as governor of the state of Alabama, have by my action raised issues between the central government and the sovereign state of Alabama, which said issues should be adjudicated in the manner prescribed by the Constitution of the United States, and now being mindful of my duties and responsibilities under the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the state of Alabama, and seeking to preserve and maintain the peace and dignity of this state and the individual freedoms of the citizens thereof, do hereby denounce and forbid this illegal and unwarranted action by the central government.
Governor Wallace, I take it from that statement that you are going to stand in that gore and that you are not going to carry out the orders of this court, and that you are going to resist us from doing so. That's correct.
I stand upon the statement.
Stand upon that statement. Governor, I'm not interested in a show. I don't know what the purpose of the show is. I am interested in the orders of these courts being enforced. That is my only responsibility here. I ask you once more, the choice is yours. There is no choice that the United States government has in this but to see that the lawful orders of its court are enforced. The consequences of your stand must rest with you. The choice is yours. I would ask you once again to responsibly step aside. And if you do not, I'm going to assure you that the orders of those courts will be enforced. Two students who simply seek an education on this campus are presently on the campus. They have a right to be here, protected by that court order. They have a right to register here. It is a simple problem, scarcely worth this kind of attention in my judgment. And those students who remain on this campus, they will register today. They will go to school tomorrow, and they will go to school at this university, at this summer session. The university has indicated its willingness to accept them. From the outset, Governor, all of us have known that the final chapter of this would be the admission of these students. I ask you once again to reconsider the consequences of your statement, and I'll ask you once again, will you give me the assurance that you'll step aside and peacefully do your duty?
But the students were turned away, and then President Kennedy took the next inevitable step. He federalized the Alabama National Guard, and as the sultry southern afternoon wore on, the wheels turned swiftly. Shortly after 5 p.m., six truckloads of federalized guardsmen rolled onto the university campus and the new commander, General Henry Graham, stepped forward, saluted the governor, and told him, "It is my sad duty to ask you to step aside." At this moment, Governor Wallace had a choice. He could stand there and be arrested, or he could leave. He made his choice.
I am very grateful to the people of Alabama for the calm and strength that they've exercised in this crisis which we have faced. And I'm going to ask that all the people of this state continue to be calm in this matter. Because if you do continue to be calm and restrained, it will help us in this fight on the matter of constitutional principles. I admire the actions and attitude of the people of this great state. We must have no violence today or any other day, because these National Guardsmen who are here today as federal soldiers are Alabamians, and they live within our borders, and they are our brothers. We are winning in this fight because we are awakening the American people to the dangers that we have spoken about so many times, which is so evident today, the trend toward military dictatorship in this country. We shall now return to Montgomery for the purpose of continuing this fight, this constitutional fight, because we are winning. We shall continue to work for a better Alabama, for all the people of this state, both white and Negro. And it is my prayer that God above shall bless all the people of this state, both white and black.
The storm center of this cold constitutional crisis was two young people. They seemed well aware of the vast implications of their case, but quietly and soberly, they stressed their personal hopes.
Well, I would just like to say that I'm glad that the registration is over and everything is over now. I think we can get down to studying. This is our main purpose here, and I'm glad that it has all been over now, and all we have to do now is get down, go get our books, and start studying. That's all.
Well, I'd like to say that at this time, this is our first and final press conference, and we'd like to say that we are very happy to note that our registration has taken place without incident, and we hope that we will be able to get on to our main purpose for being here, and that is to get an education. And this is our final statement.
There was no trouble as Vivian Malone and James Hood registered, and as they were assigned the dormitories in which each will live alone for the time being. The day is not ended, but this episode is. Ended with the message to the nation just broadcast by President Kennedy. But it is not an isolated incident. It fits into the life of the South and the history of this nation. CBS News correspondent Dan Rather has been covering the Alabama story on the scene. Here is his assessment of what this day means.
The University of Alabama campus and the city of Tuscaloosa are completely quiet this evening. The two Negro students who were enrolled this afternoon with the backing of 150 federalized National Guardsmen, Vivian Malone of Mobile, Alabama, and Jimmy Hood of Gadsden, are in their respective dormitory rooms. Both of the Negro students are, for at least a while, going to be living alone in private rooms, but their dormitory rooms are in regular dormitory buildings on the campus. There has not been even a sign of an incident any time today as far as the university students are concerned. The same can be said of the city of Tuscaloosa proper. Security for both the campus and the city remains in the hands of the Alabama State Troopers, local sheriff's deputies, and a few state conservation men who've been pressed into service. Governor George Wallace said before the Negroes enrolled today that his state troopers could and would maintain order. There was some question until today whether Governor Wallace would leave the state troopers on the campus of the university and in the city of Tuscaloosa once federal force was used to get the Negroes in. But just before leaving the campus today, Governor Wallace made it clear that his troopers would remain on the campus and in Tuscaloosa proper as long as necessary to maintain order. Shortly after he made that statement, the federalized National Guardsmen marched away from the registration building. This was after the Negro students had been registered, and the security remains in the hands of those state troopers, all quiet, both in Tuscaloosa and on the university campus. This is Dan Rather in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
The next phase of the struggle will be carried out in law and, of course, in the federal Congress. On the legal side of the issue, Governor Wallace contended that the provisions of the 10th Amendment of the Constitution reserving powers to the states if they are not specifically delegated to the federal government or denied to the states, gave him authority to resist the U.S. court orders. In effect, he was claiming that Alabama's sovereignty enabled it to nullify the Supreme Court's school desegregation decision of 1954. This is a doctrine sometimes called interposition. It goes back to the War of 1812 and the debate of the 1830s over South Carolina's attempt to nullify a federal tariff that was unpopular in the South. President Andrew Jackson rejected the doctrine in a strong message, but the issue never came to a head since compromise tariff legislation was worked out in Congress. But Jackson's famous toast of that time, "Our federal union, it must be preserved," is a classic of American history. Chief Justice John Marshall, whose Supreme Court decisions shaped the federal system, was a strong proponent of nationalism and judicial supremacy, and he once declared that the Constitution would become a mockery if the states could annul federal court decisions. Governor Wallace said his objections to the enrollment of Negroes at Alabama centered on his belief that education is a matter for state control. But the Supreme Court has held since 1954 that no state can segregate by race in its public schools because this violates equal protection of the laws. And former Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes said as far back as 1932 in an opinion that no state governor could nullify a federal court order because if he could, the fiat of a state governor, in Justice Hughes' words, and not the Constitution, would be the supreme law of the land. Presidential authority to back up federal laws and court rulings has been a part of American life since the 18th century. George Washington called out the army to repress the so-called whiskey rebellion among Pennsylvania farmers who objected to a federal tax on whiskey, which was their major source of earnings. Federal troops were also used in 1877 to quell riots connected with widespread railroad strikes. And President Grover Cleveland sent U.S. soldiers to Chicago to break a railway strike in 1894. President Kennedy has made use of a law originally invoked by President Ulysses Grant to suppress Ku Klux Klan activity in South Carolina in 1871. And he also used the statute relied on by President Washington to crush the whiskey rebellion in Pennsylvania to federalize the Alabama National Guard. Former President Franklin Roosevelt sent federal troops to Detroit to help put down a race riot in 1943, but in that case, he acted at the request of the governor of Michigan. The desegregation of public schools in the Deep South, ordered by the courts, triggered the use of federal troops in Little Rock and in Mississippi in recent years. The case of Mississippi's Governor Ross Barnett fairly closely parallels the Kennedy administration's duel with Governor George Wallace. Both defied a court order to block entry of Negroes to a state university. Governor Barnett, who eventually yielded when federal troops arrived at Oxford following bloody riots, still faces criminal contempt charges as a result of his actions.